Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time, the season's past, when 22 men graced the Bracken fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larkin.
Yep.
He hails from Portland, Oregon. This is Joe Spires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Oh, good to be here, Bob. For as many years as we've been doing the show, I still find myself humming and whistling along to the theme song. You know, when you're bringing it up, I love it.
It's a catchy football tune to get everyone in the mood to talk about football cards.
What is
football
it?
Memorabilia and football history. It's a Notre Dame march song.
Oh, wait.
What is it?
I've got it memorized by now. And I'm whistling, and I'm tapping my feet, and it's fun. It's great.
It's one of the most classic football marching songs there is by Notre Dame University. It's an amazing song. Well, we're back with another show. We've got a special guest, very special guest coming up soon. But before we get into that and our special guests, we're going to talk a little bit about another step in our series of looking at older football card sets. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the 1950 Bowman set. We talked about the 48 Bowman set a while ago. And as we know, there was no set of football cards produced by Bowman in 1949. There was a baseball set. We've speculated over the years why they never produced the 1949 Bowman football set. We will never know the true reasoning behind it. But 1950 was a transitional year for a lot of different things in football because the AAFC basically disbanded and three teams were sent into the NFL. And the 50 Bowman set came back and was out. There was a issue by Topps, which is basically a 1949-50 issue of felt-back cards, but they weren't professional. They were college players. So 1950 Bowman was the only set out there that actually looked at professional players. And, Joe, I'm going to hand off to you because you have, and we've talked about this on the show over the years, some incredible uncut sheets of that set.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely love it. And everybody, if you're a listener to the show, you know that I absolutely love uncut sheets. And one of the prides of my set is I have all four uncut sheets that comprise the 144 cards that go into the 1950 Bowman set. I love the Bowmans. I mean, if you think about it, it's 48, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55. I mean, it was a very short glimpse, and all of the Bowmans I love. I think all of them have a special place in my heart. I mean, 53s are probably my favorite. I just love the coloring on it. But 52s are amazing. 51s, I think, have great layouts. I mean, just all of them. I mean, but it's kind of like children. You can't really have a favorite, and I know the captain has never come across a football set he doesn't love, so it's hard for him to break it down either. But I mean, it's kind of funny during the preamble of the show. I'm like, I love the Bowmans, Philadelphia, you know, the Phillies, you know, the 66. I'm like, man, I love the Phillies. The Fleers are really good too. The 61 Fleers set, really. And next thing you know, I'm like, yeah, Tops are pretty good too. Damn it, I love all football. It's just what it boils down to. They're all good looking. But
the 50 Bowman to me was so unique because you went from a black and white set in 1948.
Yep.
To the 1950 color set, and it was just so much more lively. And it was still, we're still not at a point yet of a real size football card as we know today. So it's still that small card, and, you know, it's an amazing set. And, again, that's a set that's just chock full of Hall of Famers, stars, rookies, and anything you want to look at, you really get it in that particular set. And realistically, I look back, that, as much as it was difficult to collect for me, and again, I put that together back in the 80s, it still was relatively, you know, with a lot of searching back then, I was able to put that set together pretty easily, in my opinion, compared to other 1950 sets and other Bowman sets that I put together over the years.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. At one point, you know, I was trying to put together every set, and 50 Bowman was one of the easiest to put together. And I remember the number 100, the Sammy Baugh, was my last card to complete, and it was just, that one was a tough one. But as you mentioned, 48, you know, 1948, Bowman went head-to-head with Leaf. There's no comparison, a nice color Leaf card versus a black and white. You know, Bowman took a year off and came back. Full force, Leaf goes out of business in 1949 after the skipped numbered 49 Leaf set that was basically a recreation of the 48. Off they go. They go head-to-head with a young Topps company, which really didn't put forth much of an effort in 1950. I mean, but that, I've heard them referred to as barely a square, you know, a little bit short of a square, but they were 2 1/16 inch by 2.5, so just a little bit shy of a square. 48 and 50 both followed that same, you know, same size before 51 moved into, you know, the standard card set. But, you know, 48 Bowman was, you know, was a smaller set. It was 108 cards, three sheets, 36 cards per sheet, four rows, nine columns. And 50 Bowman followed that same layout, except they added 36 cards, a Series D sheet. So 144 cards, 36 cards a sheet times four sheets. Great set. I mean, just packed full of rookie cards. Otto Graham, you know, AAFC. I mean, and it's great because 48 Leaf was, you know, some college, some NFL, you know, but no AAFC. And then you get into 50 Bowman, it's right after the merger of AAFC and the NFL into 13 teams, and 144 divided by 13 teams, you start to see a really good representation of each team. You know, that's 10,
exactly.
10 cards per team on average, yep, which is really good, you know, considering, you know, a lot of guys played ball both ways. So you got really, really good representation of teams. the Browns, 49ers, and the then Baltimore Colts, you know, representing the AFC, and then the 10 NFL teams. Otto Graham, Crazy Legs, Elroy Hirsch, one of my favorite cards. I just love that. You know, some really, really cool designs. I mean, you've got Tank Younger, you know, who's, you know, very popular player, you know, doing the Heisman pose with the American flag running in the background, you know, Lou the Toe, you know, it's got so many Hall of Famers in it. It's just, it's such a colorful, cool, chock full of talent set.
When you think about vintage sets, and, you know, I've talked about this privately with a lot of collectors over the years, I can get excited to a certain degree with the 48-49 Leafs, but really with Bowman, you can get very excited looking at collecting the 1950 set, even if you just put your team together, a team set from your favorite team or whatever. But you can really appreciate, especially now, 72 years later, the true vintage nature of the set. And, you know, we could say it's almost primitive printing that we're looking at, but it's held time and time over again. It's held up in 72 years. So you do see nice cards out there. And, again, when I put my set together, I will go out on a limb and say, I did see a bunch of ex-near mint cards over the years. You know, I never considered really one of those early cards to be just near mint, but I always said I saw a lot of better condition 1950 Bowman cards and Bowman in general than I ever did in the 48 or 49 Leafs, if you can follow that. So again, that's the beginning of a very, very strong vintage period, the beginning of the 1950s, classic 10-year period for football cards, evolution of football cards, and it really, you know, it truly began. It didn't begin with the Feltbacks. It began with the 50 Bowman set, to say the least.
Yeah.
So
I wonder why that is.
It's a great set.
The Bowmans came in nickel packs with six cards a pack, so maybe they're protected a little bit better in nickel packs.
Well, that's what I wonder. I kind of think their stock that they used to print them on was better than the Leaf stock, number one. And number two, yeah, I think you're correct in saying if you got six cards together in a pack, they're holding firmer. And if they, you know, they were the classic wax packs, they were sealed properly. No air got into them, so on and so forth. So
yeah.
I think they held the test of time for a long, you know, much better than other card sets. And as such, you know, they're still in, you can still find them in the market. You can still put the set together.
Yep.
And, you know, it's a nice set. It's a classic set, truly classic.
Yeah. You can pick up a PSA 8 common 1950 Bowman card, as you mentioned, a 72-year-old card and PSA 8, you know, near mint. You can pick up a common for $50, you know, $70. You know, Elroy, you're going to get the big Hall of Famers. The Otto Graham probably being the most expensive. I mean, a PSA 9 Otto Graham is going to cost you $25,000 or $30,000. It used to be, you know, $5,000 to $7,000, but you know, the rest of them, you can build this set pretty cheaply, which is surprising because if you bought a nickel pack of 1950 Bowman and you ripped that, you know, at a national dinner in front of all your friends, and you got one PSA 8 out of it, everybody high fiving. Or you could just go buy a PSA 8. It's kind of funny. But the 48 Leafs, they come in, you know, petty packs. You know, so, I mean, much harder condition-wise on those, I would imagine. But Bowman had just an amazing run, if you think about it. They ruled it from 50 to, you know, 55, and then they just got bumped, as we've talked about, by Topps All-American trying to get right back into the market.
Yep. And then the one thing I also will compare the 48 Bowman to the 50 Bowman. The 48 Bowman was a very drab, black and white set. It didn't age well, in my opinion, over the years. You know, there's a lot of toning on the cards. The divisible by three cards, the short prints were always brutal to try to find. That was a tough set for me to put together. And that took me quite a while because I was short on several of the short prints through the 90s until I just happened upon them and I finished my set. And my 48 Bowman set, no way, shape, or form grades any better than a VG with a handful of X cards and mostly fair, good VG condition, especially for the divisible by three cards, the short prints. But my 50 set, like I said, it's a nice set. It presents well. It looks nice. And it's just amazing what those two difference in 2 years did as far as the sets are concerned.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, 48 Bowman are headshots. They're headshots with the player looking straight away into the camera. The 50 Bowman, they mixed it up. You know, it's close-ups of every player is kicking, catching, running, you know, Heisman posing, et cetera. A lot more action. And add the color. And it's cool. There's, you know, American flags sprinkled in there. As silly as it sounds, there's really amazing detail. There's a card, I forget what one it is, but the person's running, and you can literally see that the artist, you know, put in tufts of turf coming off the person's shoe as they're cutting the corner. And I forget the player, but I sat there enamored looking at this card when I got it. I'm like, the detail, you know, on the cards are amazing. You can see grass flying off their foot, off their cleat as they're running in his car. I think the player starts with a Z. I forget. I'd have to go back, but...
Yeah, it was definitely a well prepared, well drawn out set, well thought out set. Much better than the 48 Bowman.
And the set has a very special place in my heart, simply because I have the set, but I also have the set very prominently displayed in frames of uncut sheets behind me. It's one of my most proud uncut sheets, just to have an entire set. All four, you know, series, you know, ABCD, you know, of I have no other sheets that are like that. Modern ones, but I love that. It took me 6 or 7 years to assemble that red by one here, one there. I was piecing it together, and it was just it was a triumph.
It's an incredible. Incredible set, and you have an incredible collection there of those four uncut sheets, few and far between. Probably you and maybe one other person has it, and that's it. It's amazing, truly amazing.
Yeah.
Well, our special guest is here, and I don't want to keep him waiting, and I'd like to introduce him to our audience tonight. He's well-known to our audience and readers of Gridiron Greats magazine. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats magazine, a lifelong fan, historian of the San Francisco 49ers, author of numerous books on the 49ers, and he's personal friend to the king, the late, great Hugh McElhaney. He hails from San Francisco.
And I'd like to welcome our good friend, Martin Jacobs, to the show. Martin.
Hello, Bob. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Good.
We're good.
Good.
Thank you for coming. Wish it was under better circumstances, Martin.
Yeah, I'm still grieving over the loss of the king. It was like losing a second father to me, you know, because I've been close with McElhaney since I was 9 years old, and I'm 79 now. Yeah. So when I heard that news, it was just like a shock, you know, and shockwave went through me. It was just really terrible, but I have a lot of things to remember him by, a lot of memories and a lot of memorabilia, but just losing the king was just terrible for me. But I'm doing okay now. You know, I'm doing okay. Nobody seems to understand how your hero can cause you such grief, but, you know, McElhaney meant a lot to me, and he inspired me all through my life. But go ahead, Bob.
He was a very, very important person to you, Martin, and you know, I don't think anybody in the football world takes that lightly. You know, when Bart Starr died, you know, I never got an opportunity. I always wanted to, I had this fantasy I was going to meet him somehow at an autograph signing or whatever, and never panned out. And it's like my balloon got popped when
when Starr died. So I feel for you. I understand.
Yeah, you know, what the fans don't understand is that McElhinney was a special runner on the field, and
yep.
and I can't get over the point to people how unselfish he was as a runner. And they don't
yeah.
understand that they you know because today they hit the line the backs and it's off to the race as fast as you can go. McElhinney was a little bit different, and what made him different is that he used his blockers, and it wasn't that he was afraid to get hit and anything like that. It was just that he felt when he got in the open field and he had blockers, he would slow down and change pace just to wait for, like, Bob St. Clair, a big tackle, or Leo Namalini when he was playing tackle, to come downfield, and he'd slow up so they could take out the defender, and then he would run towards the end zone. And one particular memory I have, which dates back to 1955, we were playing the Cleveland Browns, and McElhinney broke loose on a 75-yard run. Now, he had clear sailing all the way to the end zone running down the sidelines. He got down to about the 10-yard line, and two Rams had an angle on him. And what McElhinney did is he slowed up just almost to a standstill, waited for two blockers to come over, take out the two Browns, and walk into the end zone. Now, who does that? You know... He captured my attention, and I became a McElhinney fan when I was 9 years old. And if you'd like, I could tell you a story how I met McElhinney. Would you like to hear that?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, what happened is when I was
I
was 9 years old at Kezar, and my dad said, and I didn't know a difference between a lateral and a forward pass at that time. And my dad said, look through my binoculars at number 39. He's a rookie. It's his first year. So I looked through the binoculars, and I saw McElhinney the first time he carried the ball against the Cardinals. It was a preseason game. And he ran 44 yards for a touchdown. And the way he zigged and zagged around the field and changed pace and straight arm, brought a high stepping and shoulder fakes, the whole bit. Well, I got hooked just from watching McElhinney then. And so what happened is during the season, after the last game of the season against the Baltimore Colts, I went into the Kezar Stadium parking lot, and that's where the 49er locker rooms were. Now, McElhinney came out. And at that time, McElhinney had these Hollywood looks. He looked like a movie star. People compared him to Charles Bronson, some to Patrick Swayze now. But anyway, he had long black hair, and he was really handsome. So all the girls who went to the game, there were women, too, and young girls, and they would stand in line to get his autograph. Well, I stood in line to get his autograph, and I happened to be the last one in line. So I got to McElhinney, and he was sitting in his pink Cadillac, and I went to give him my program to sign, and he said, "See you next year, kid." And he drove off. Well, I was so disappointed. I mean, my heart was broken, you know, because I collected news clippings and everything, and I go, wow, that really hurt. But the following season, this is 1955, after the final preseason game against the Cleveland Browns, they changed uniforms for the season because the ones they used in the preseason were from the year before. So again, I'm in the parking lot of Kezar. I stand in line. I get to McElhinney. And I said the first thing to McElhinney, sitting in his car, I said, "Remember me? You're the one who told, see you next year, kid." He says, "Sure, I remember you." He took my program and he signed it, "Best Wishes, Hugh McElhinney." Well, I was thrilled. And just when I was going to walk away, McElhinney said to me, he said, "Hey, kid, would you like my jersey?" And I said, "Sure, I would." And he took out of a little duffel bag his jersey rolled up that he used. He said to me he was on his way to the boys' club to give it to them for a raffle. So I got the jersey, and that was my first collectible from McElhinney. And I've had it all these years. Now, how I got to meet McElhinney personally, I was at a collector show in San Francisco, a card show. He was signing autographs. and I brought the shirt that he gave me from 1955. Now, this is 1980, and I gave him the shirt, and he signed it, and the first thing he said, "Where the hell did you get this?" He didn't even remember giving it to me. So I gave it to Macklin. He signed it, and then I said, out of the blue, "Macklin, could I get your phone number so I could call you sometime?" Well, I don't think he was going to give it to me, but his wife, Peggy, was sitting with him, and she says, "Why don't you give it to him? He's a big fan of yours." And you gave him that shirt. So I got his phone number, and since about 1980, we have been corresponding, I'd say every couple of weeks by telephone. And I followed him around. He ended up living in Henderson, Nevada, and and during that period, I collected everything of McElhinney from the time that I saw him through the binoculars. I have his college All-Star game jersey, his East-West game jersey, 49er jersey, Vikings jersey, his Jack 59 jacket. I have two capes that he wore from 59 and 54. I have a signed helmet by him. I have every program that he played in from college. I have most of his high school games, but I have all his college, all his pro games, Hula Bowl, Pro Bowls. I have every card that was produced by McElhinney and signed by McElhinney. So I'm really a fanatic for Hugh McElhinney, and people don't understand that. And I always try to keep his spirit alive. If I can ever talk about running backs or comparing players, I always bring up McElhinney. Because at one time I coached Pop Warner football, and I taught my running backs just like how McElhinney ran, with a straight arm and lifting the knees up. And what a lot of people don't know is McElhinney was a ballet. He took ballet classes in school. And that's why he had great, not only great vision, but great balance. And I always said if he was behind a Rams line or Cleveland Browns or something, because the 49ers never won a championship in the 50s with him. The closest they got was in 57. But it wasn't McElhinney's fault. We just didn't have a very good defense, but we could score a lot of points. But that's how I met McElhinney, and that's been a long, lifelong relationship, and I'm going to miss the guy. I mean, it's just really hard on me losing Mac. And he, not only that, he was very modest. When I talked to him on the telephone, and any time I would give him a compliment, he'd laugh it off. That's nothing. That was nothing. He just didn't take. He played hard, and he got a lot of bruises, and he told me a lot of stories through the years, but the guy's got no ego. He just did a job, played well, and in fact, when they drafted McElhinney, he had a reputation of being a problem kid, but because he didn't like to practice, he came late to practice, but when he got to the 49ers, the funny thing is, when he got to the Niners, he said he didn't like to block. He had a reputation. He didn't like to block. So he didn't block for the Niners at first. So the 49ers got together, and they said, "Well, we're not going to block for McElhinney." So when McElhinney ran a few times and got dumped, he said, "Why aren't you blocking for me?" He said, "Well, you're not blocking for us." So all of a sudden, McElhinney became a good blocker, but he came with a little attitude when he got to the 49ers, because he was a big star up at the University of Washington, and he said he made more money playing college ball than he ever made for the 49ers. He signed with the Niners for $7,000, and he asked for $30,000, and they told him to go have another cup of coffee, so he took the $7,000, but he was getting paid a lot of money up at University of Washington. So, like I said, McElhinney's one of a kind. He's a real special guy, real humble. Yeah.
Well, Martin, just seriously, you're rattling this off, and the only thing that comes to mind is just, we are not worthy. I mean, just hearing you tell stories of, about the King. Just we're not worthy, you know. Just you know, just you got close to a, you know, to your hero, your favorite player. My heart breaks for you. When I heard this news, I immediately, you know, last time we had you on the show, you were, you know, you just written your book, The King. I went on and bought a copy of it, that you inscribed for me, and it was a great read. I'm a fan. I'm a Steve Largent fan, but hearing you talk about this stuff, it pales in comparison. I'm a fan. You are a super fan, and just.
And I'm more of a fanatic. I would say, you know, when I won Fan of the Year in 2000, as the number one 49er fan, it was a contest by Visa International for the top fan of the NFL for your favorite team. Well, when I submitted my resume for the fan, I knew at that time, I don't think there was another person in this country that was as close to a player and idolized the player and collected with the player. And when I won, it didn't surprise me because I put my heart's into the 49ers, and it hurt a lot of relationships I've had, like with my, I've been divorced a couple times, and one wife said you loved Hugh McElhinney more than her, and the other one said you loved Joe Montana more than her, but I didn't argue the fact, I loved him in a different way, but I never denied it, you know, I really cared a lot for McElhinney, just the way he carried himself and the way he, the funny thing about it, when in his rookie year, 1952, when they introduced the players onto the field at Kezar Stadium, they came out of a tunnel. McElhinney was the only guy who came out of the tunnel not wearing his helmet. He carried his helmet under his arm, and he's waving to all these cheering ladies and young girls. And I, at that time, I wasn't a McElhinney fan, and I was wondering, who is this guy? It's like the Lone Ranger with the guy with the mask. Who is this guy? Because he was like showing off, you know. But that was McElhinney, you know. He was like a womanizer. The girls just were crazy. They just wanted to touch him. But I was a young kid then. I didn't really know McElhinney till 1980 when we became friends and how humble he was. And football was just, it just wasn't what it was to me. You know, to him it was a job. To me it was my life. You know, I just love watching him play. So I've been a 49er fan all these years, and I still cheer for the Niners, but not like, they're not the kind of players they had when back in the 1950s, that golden age. It was just a whole different era.
I want to dive down on how you became friends with them. I mean, and we've had you on before. We know, I've read the book, but I mean, as I mentioned, I've collected Steve Largent for a long time. I've met him a few times. Never did I think, like, you know, hey, would you mind if I got your cell phone? I'd love exchanging stories with you. It's just, and it's so simple, but it worked. And this is back in, I think you said 1980. There's no cell phone. It's, you know, he gave you his house number.
That's right.
Started calling it up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did that simple, like, hey, would you mind? I mean, because you got his attention. When you slide him something that he'd never seen before, and he's like, where did you get this? You know, that's a story. He's curious about it. I'm sure once you told him, you know, his interest was piqued. But how did that go from where the hell did you get this to becoming a friend?
Okay. I have to credit my father. He told me where there's a will, there's a way. Okay. He always said anything is possible. Just go for it. And so I remember when I played high school football, and I ran like McElhinney at the time. I got benched because the coach would call like a plunge up the middle, and I'd do an 88 loop and run around the corner. And I would tell him, well, if McElhinney could do it, I could do it. And I got benched for it. But the thing of it is that it was my dad who gave me and I give credit to my mother. She never made it easy for me. She made me research. And if I'd ask her what the weather was, she would tell me, well, call up the weatherman. So the same thing when I mentioned McElhinney to my dad. He says, well, why don't you ask, get his phone number? Why don't you call him? This and that. So I took the initiative to do those things. And that's how I did it. I have five children, and they're all in business for themselves. And I told them the same thing, you know. I said, you got to have a little courage and go for it. And if you lose, you fall down, you get up and try again. So I just had the nerve to ask McElhinney for his phone number. And at first he was hesitant. He was thinking about it, but his wife said, give it to him, you know. He has your shirt and he's your fan. That's how it happens, you know. You just got to take that extra step, and I've always been able to do it. God's blessed me that I've been able to. I had some other heroes like Muhammad Ali. I met Muhammad Ali. Same thing. I got through to get to Muhammad Ali. I went through some newspaper in L.A., and then I met his agent. We went to his house, and I met Ali. I had his robe and trunks, and it just takes the will to go out and do it, you know. And that's how I met McElhinney. It was probably the best thrill I've had in my life. And I can write 10 books on McElhinney, you know, from all the stories he's given me. And
yeah.
He's one tough guy. He was a tough guy. He was Irish. He was just he was also a high school champion hurdler. He was good in other sports, a sprinter. But he said he couldn't beat Joe Perry in a 50-yard dash. But he's very humble and honest and just a great guy. And his wife was very nice, too. He lost his wife 2 years ago, and he said he didn't know if he could survive without Peggy. And he lasted about 2 or 3 years after Peggy. But like I said, a big blow to me when I heard I lost the king. He'll always be the king in my eyes. Like King, there was Elvis Presley was the king in music. He was the king.
Indeed. Well, you are the fan. You are the fanatic of fans, for sure.
Yeah, a definite fan of the king. You know, I love the 49ers. I wish them the best and everything, but I'll never have the relationship like I had with McElhinney. You know, they played for the love of the game.
Yep.
He loved the game. Now the players, you know, there's so many not so much trades, but free agents. I don't know from year to year who's starting and who's not starting, and it's just a whole different. It's strictly business now. It's not like the old days. And thank God I grew up in the 50s and 60s and those years, you know. And it was a great time. Great time.
Martin, is there one game that stands out for you that he played in that you'll always remember? Was there a play in a game, anything like that you could
yes,
tell our audience?
There's one particular play in probably the history of the 49ers which involved McElhinney. In 1957, we played the Detroit Lions in a playoff game. We led the Detroit Lions 31-7 at halftime. Everybody was celebrating. We were going to go to the championship and play the Cleveland Browns. So the third quarter opened up. We're leading 31-7. McElhinney runs 77 yards. He gets down to the 9-yard line, and he told me he just ran out of gas at that time because he must have run 200 yards to run that 77. Okay, the 49ers ended up kicking a field goal, and I felt in my mind that we should have scored that. McElhinney should have scored that touchdown, because the Detroit Lions could still come back. But to have another touchdown lead might have put them out of reach. Well, they ended up winning by 3 points. So that by McElhinney not getting into the end zone and getting seven, instead of they kicked a field goal and got three, and they ended up losing the game. And I'll never forget that. And when I tell Hugh about it, he laughs about it. And he just ran out of gas, he said. I think Yale Larry was the last one to tackle him, and he went down at the 9. But he ran 77 yards. So the play that sticks out of McElhinney has to be that one, the one that he didn't score.
The one that he didn't.
Wow.
I love that.
Yeah. I was very depressed that game because we thought we were going to the championship. In fact, at halftime, the 49ers printed up 55,000 tickets for the game, and it never happened. I have one of those Anthem tickets, yeah.
Seriously, I was mentioning, we've had you on the show before, and you've talked about, you know, your days when you were, selling food and drinks, at Keysar. But I mean, so you've seen it since you were nine all the way up. You've seen
right. Well,
49ers.
You know, when I sold at Keysar and when I was a vendor there, the reason I got the job there is that again I asked my father, and my father says, well, you know, he says you could always go work for them. And I said, well, I can't play for them. He says, why don't you sell for them? Sell their products and things. So I went there, and I started with the penis popcorn, then I ended up with the hot dogs and the souvenirs, and I worked there for 13 years. But I can honestly say that I never missed one single 49er play because when I was selling, I kneeled down when they broke huddle, got up to the line, did their play, and 20 seconds
smart.
Later, I'm selling again.
That's very smart. That's cool.
Yeah, so I never missed a play. And then when I finished working for them, I opened up my sports stores, the Sports Stop, and I sold 49er souvenirs for the next 30 years. And when I retired from that, I ended up writing books. I've done 12 books. Nine on the 49ers, actually, and then three on World War II. I'm also a World War II historian. But so the 49ers has been my life. I've able to always do something connected with the 49ers, and that's since 9 years old. So you could say it's a lifetime dream come true.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So, in your opinion, you've seen every play. You said you'd kneel down, you'd break huddles. What was the best team that was fielded during that era, that 46-60, when you were doing that?
I missed the question on that one.
In your opinion, what was the best 49er team from that 46-60?
Oh man, that's a tough one. But I have to say, well, the 57 team made it to the playoffs.
Yep.
But my favorite was the 1954 team because they had the $1 million backfield, and that was Hugh McElhinney, Tittle, Johnson, Perry. And when they played together, God, you didn't know. Each one was a threat to go for a touchdown. They had a great offense back there with White, Tittle, and all those guys. So I would say, I'd have to say if I had to eliminate to one, be the 1954 49er team. In fact, they started off 7-0, and then McElhinney got hurt. Tittle broke his jaw. White Tittle broke his jaw. They had a special helmet made for him with a handle on it. Tittle used to say he hated that handle because linemen would grab the handle when they tackled him, and he twisted his neck, and he said he hated that. But McElhinney broke his shoulder. So the year ended up not too well, but when they were healthy, that was the team. That was the 54 49ers.
Now, that's cool. Boy, Wyatt Tittle was a tough old bird, wasn't he?
They dumped him.
Iconic picture of him kneeling with blood coming out of his ears.
Yeah, the 49ers dumped him, and then the Giants picked him up, and he took him to 3 championship games. And the reason he got dumped, by the Niners, is our offensive line just needed help, and they didn't give him the protection. But he came back and played the 49ers, and he threw 5 touchdown passes against us. So Tittle still was a real competitor when he went to New York. And then McElhinney ended up in New York with the Giants on a championship team. 49ers let him go, too, because that was another downer in my life when Red Hickey came in. He changed the 49er offense to the shotgun offense and ran an offense that had 3 quarterbacks. And McElhinney was let go, Joe Perry was let go, and Tittle got let go. So, and they still had playing days left, but that was a tough time when McElhinney left the 49ers, you know.
Yep.
But he said he had his best year when he went to Minnesota.
I was going to ask about his Minnesota playing days. I forget that he went there. Expansion team, Van Brocklin was the coach. Did he ever tell you any stories about when he played with the Vikings? I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah. He had his best season ever with the the Vikings, and concluding all the years with the 49ers. He ended up with over 800 yards rushing and yards. Yeah, and he made the Pro Bowl, and he was the Vikings' leading rusher. He had a great season. But like I said, Red Hickey came in here and just changed everything and sent McElhinney to the expansion draft, and Minnesota picked him up. But the only thing I have of McElhinney is a few cards from the Vikings that he played, and I have a game jersey from his 1961 season. Then he got traded to New York, and then he went to a championship game. Yep, that's... like I said, I could write a book, another book just on the stories that Hugh told me and stuff, but I can't overdo it, really.
hearing you talk about King being traded to Minnesota, I mean, it's got to be tough. I mean, I think back to, Bill Walsh talking about, the day that he traded Joe Montana and then later Jerry Rice. I mean, the greatest receiver in the history of the NFL, probably one of the greatest quarterbacks, gets released eventually. And, and Walsh was like, I love, Joe Montana, but at some point Steve Young is better. It's just, it's interesting. And I'm so glad I never had to suffer, the fate of seeing Steve Largent, dress up for another team, like a Jerry Rice or Hugh, McElhinney. It's just, that had to be a tough pill to swallow.
When I mentioned it to Hugh, I said, and he spoke very little bit about it, and I said, how did it feel going from San Francisco to Minnesota? He says, for Christ's sake, they didn't even give me a jock strap when I left the 49ers. They just put me in an expansion draft. He was really upset about it, and I was pretty well at that time. I wasn't too personal with McElhinney because it wasn't until 1980, but he was my hero, though. So I continued still buying the Minnesota newspapers, keeping scrapbooks. I got scrapbooks of McElhinney's, ticket stubs, everything dealing with McElhinney wherever he went. But when he left the 49ers, my heart kind of was broken,
How old were you when that happened?
When McElhinney left, I was 1960, so I was 27. No, I was 17, okay. I think, yeah.
17, yeah. Okay, I was going to say, I thought you were still in school there, but, where is that jersey? I know you said that, he handed you the jersey, he was on his way to the Boys and Girls Club, you got it autographed, and, later in 1980, that has to be, the cornerstone of your collection.
It is, Bob and Joe. But the truth of it is, I have all the jerseys hanging in a closet, and each night that I go to bed, I'll either whatever time I'll go take 10 minutes. Maybe I'll browse programs or photos. I have about 500 photos. I'll open up that closet. And all the jerseys got the plastic over it, and what I'll do is I'll just drum through them, look at McElhinney's shirt, or I'll look at one of the other 49ers shirts. I have about 60 49ers shirts from the 50s, but I'll look through McElhinney and Joe Perry and Tittle, and then I'll go off to bed. It's just something that it's a ritual that I kind of do each night, It's a fanatic. That's what a fanatic does. I'm just a fanatic.
So that jersey that you got as a kid, that you got autographed in 1980, is hanging in your closet.
Yeah, it's just hanging, but with that plastic over it that the cleaners gives you,
Incredible.
It just protects it from the moths and stuff. But, yeah, I just look at it, and all the shirts I have are autographed by McElhinney, and every time I get something, he would go, "Where'd you get that?" He was such a character, that guy. But, he didn't put value in it. He says, "Hey, you got to be nuts to want my stuff." I says, "No." I says, "I just collected. I admire you, Mac." We almost get in an argument over it, but he was my hero, And it goes back,
Martin,
way back.
For this issue of the summer issue of Gridiron Greats, you wrote about a pickup collection. Can you tell our audience about that?
Oh, yeah, that was a great pickup. I picked up his University of Washington game jersey that he wore in 1951. And the thing of it is, I was going to buy that jersey years before from a collector named Gus Ledone, and Gus Ledone unfortunately passed away. And I was just going to send him a check for the jersey, and it disappeared. I heard it went to Gus Ledone's brother, and I lost track of his brother. And then for years, I guess 17 years went by, that I got a call from a Nick Coppola in Boston, who's I think affiliated with Gray Flannel Auctions. And he says, are you interested in McElhinney's Washington jersey? And I said, I sure am. And so I got the jersey, and I mailed it to Mac, and he signed it. And it's hanging in the closet.
It's hanging in the closet.
Unbelievable.
You knew him a long time. You got to know him personally. It reminds me of, like, you know, Todd Tobias and Lance Allworth, where they just get together personally. It just did Hugh ever give you anything from his personal collection? Did he collect memorabilia from his playing years? That, you know, did he ever, like, this was very special to me, this was my you know whatever touchdown, et cetera, I want you to have it, you're my super fan?
Well, here's the thing. Before McElhinney passed away, he had still in his office his MVP trophy, his Pro Bowl trophy, Hula Bowl trophies, and awards from Sport Magazine. A lot of them were displayed in his office. And I was told by his daughter that if anything should ever happen to McElhinney, you would be the first one we'll contact if you're interested in anything more of McElhinney. So I'm not waiting for the phone to ring because you know, I wish McElhinney was still alive. But there is more memorabilia out there of McElhinney, but there's a lot of special things. And the things that were special to him were the trophies and the award certificate. He had one from George Halas saying that he was the best player he ever saw run. So there's a chance I might pick up some more things if they do come about. I'll make the decision then, you know, because I have so much as it is. I have a whole room full of memorabilia, a lot of it from McElhinney. But
did he ever give you anything personally? Like, you know, like, Martin, I want you to have this. This is special to me and you're special to me. Did he ever give you anything?
Actually, no, except for autographs. I didn't have to pay for autographs, and I have all the cards and lots of photos. I remember a couple of my collector friends would say, now, why do you got to have McElhinney sign every photo that you have? I says, I just like to. He has a beautiful signature. He had one of the nicest signatures of all the players. Really nice. And now the players, the way they sign, they just scribble. That just eats me up. I just can't believe it that when I see a signature with just a little couple of lines, you know, the way they do it. I'm just glad I grew up
like
when I did.
It's like hieroglyphics trying to figure out the player's name when they sign something. And I agree with you. I got a handful of Packer signatures from the 60s and 70s, and you can read everybody's signature perfectly. So, you know, those guys in the 50s, 60s, and the part of the 70s, they took pride in their autographs, and today it's pathetic to look at some of this stuff.
It's impossible.
It's incredible.
You know, somebody gave me a San Francisco Giants baseball, and I thought it was all Japanese or something. I couldn't make out one signature, not one signature.
Bob and I have talked extensively about the 2000 playoff contender Tom Brady card, and on it is his signature, and you can. If I didn't know that card, I wouldn't know that was his signature. It is tough.
Not only that, I can imagine the forgeries that must be. That's why I'm just happy that I'm not collecting the material today that they sell, even though they go for thousands of dollars, because I've been to China and I've seen how they knock off stuff. You can't tell. I mean, they really do a good job. They sell, like, pro jerseys there in China for $20, And I, with the sewn numbers and letters and NFL emblems, and here they go for $200 or $300. And I say, oh, wow. So I wouldn't be happy collecting today's material at all.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Martin, we got about 3 minutes left. One other point, or two other points, I want to ask you. Do you have a favorite piece of memorabilia with the thousands of pieces you have? And can you give any advice to a beginning collector?
Okay, the favorite piece has to be the 1955 jersey that I got from McElhinney. That has to be the top of the line. The second probably favorite piece is an autographed football when the 49ers made the playoffs in 57 before they lost to the Lions, I have a football, an autographed football has all the team, including McElhinney, and that's probably a favorite item. And, of course, one of the first items I got from McElhinney was a chin strap. When he walked off the field, I asked for his chin strap. And that's kind of sentimental, you know, getting a free chin strap from the player. And as far as advice for a collector, I'd say it's like anything else. Passion has to be number one. Even if you collect, open a store or whatever, or a sport you play, you got to have passion. You just can't collect to collect, because if you do that, then it's the value's not there. I would just say you got to have the passion, almost like the kind of passion I had for McElhinney. And if you want to be successful, because if you have the passion, you'll do your research, you'll care about it, and that's my advice for anybody starting to collect.
Absolutely.
If it's any particular item, each item is different. You have to go to different avenues for different items, but it starts with the passion, strictly.
I agree.
Yeah.
Martin, this has been an incredible look back, your living history of you, of the 49ers.
Totally.
I truly appreciate all the work you do for the magazine, and I appreciate every time you've been on the show. I picked up something new, and I just love listening to you and talk about the 49ers, because you definitely got the passion for the 49ers, and it's incredible to listen to. It's great. I appreciate it. Thanks for being on.
Okay, Bob and Joe, enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Martin Jacobs, the legendary fan, historian, fan, collector, incredible. I'm literally speechless after this show. That has been a trip down memory lane if there ever was one. We just heard the history of you, McElhinney. It's incredible.
Yep.
Joe, two-minute warning, and we are in 2 minutes. Hand off to you what you pick up on tonight's show.
Yeah, just tough. It broke my heart. I mentioned, you know, I'm a fan. You and I are both fans. You know, Martin is the epitome of a fanatic. I mean, that is where the word comes from. You know, he was rattling off the stuff that he had and how we got to know him and this. I mean, I met Steve Largent when I was a kid, but I didn't take it any further. It's just, I'm so impressed with him, and just, he's become the 49er historian. He's always so classy. I absolutely love his articles he writes, you know, for GG, for you.
Yep.
It's always a pleasure to speak to him. I just wish it was under better circumstances this go, you know. My heart breaks.
I know. You know, it's funny when he says he looks at a piece 10 minutes before he goes to bed at night or whatever.
Yeah.
He goes through his collection. I always pull out something to read, whether it's an old magazine, media guide, book, card album or whatever. So I get what he said and what he does, because I do the same exact thing. And it's cool. This show tonight really makes me feel good, because we heard history, to say the least. It's incredible, truly incredible. Website, Gridiron Greats Magazine. If you're not a subscriber, what are you waiting for? We got 10
waiting
seconds.
For.
Joe, what's going on? 10 seconds left.
Great show. Thanks for organizing on short notice, Captain.
Yeah, it's a great show. It was. I'm really happy. I'm glad Martin got to talk about his good friend. That's it for tonight. We'll be back hopefully next week with another show, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.